This episode of the Art of Manliness podcast is brought to you by Cricket Shirts. I've been talking about the players' polos from Cricket Shirts, my go-to shirt during the spring and summer, but the guys at Cricket have come out the new shirt that's gotten a lot of rotation in my wardrobe. It's their gingham button-down. Comes in classic blue and white or red and white checkered gingham. It's made from 100% Japanese milled gingham, cotton gingham, and made right here in USA in Texas. It's a great shirt, a classic piece of clothing. Looks great with a pair of shorts, sleeves rolled up for those casual summertime dates or those barbecues. If you'd like to check it out, go to cricketshirts.com. That's cricketshirts.com. And if you'd like 20% off on your first purchase, enter discount code ARTOFMAN, ARTOFMAN, at checkout for 20% off and free shipping. Again, that's discount code ARTOFMAN for 20% off and free shipping. cricketshirts.com. All right, guys, you know that we have great advertisers that support the show and keep it free for you. And one of the reasons why advertisers love Art of Manliness is that they know we have amazing fans. And right now, I have a survey that I'd love for you to take to help us learn more about our audience. Just go to podsurvey.com/artofman. The survey will only take 5 minutes. We're going to ask you some questions about yourself and what you like to buy, but it's completely anonymous. Your answers help us find advertisers that are well matched to you, your interest in the show. And when you're finished, you can enter a monthly drawing to win a $100 Amazon gift card. Once again, that's podsurvey.com/artofman. That's ARTOFMAN. Thanks for helping us find the best advertisers that we can help keep the show free. Brett McKay here, and welcome to another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. So, a common theme we write about on the website is big picture strategic thinking, how we can become better, more critical thinkers. So we've done content about the OODA loop, psychological biases that get in the way of us making good decisions that help us live a good life. Anyways, today on the show, I have a man who has dedicated his career, his life, to improving strategic thinking and critical thinking in life and death situations. His name is Tom Ruby. He served 26 years in active duty positions in the United States Air Force, from squadron intelligence officer to chief of doctrine for the Air Force Intelligence, Surveillance, and Reconnaissance Enterprise. He's also the chief of special programs for Air Force Material, and he was also on General Petraeus's Joint Strategic Assessment Team during the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. So this is a man who has dedicated himself to writing documents that have been used in the military, developing strategy, and how not only officers but soldiers on the ground can think more critically in life and death situations. Anyways, fascinating character. And today on the show, Tom and I discuss thinking strategically, how we can do it better. We discuss how we can think critically. And so whether you are a guy working for a corporation or you own your own business, knowing how to strategize is something that will get you far in life. So we discuss the topics, the subtopics you should focus on in order to become a better strategizer. And among other things, we discuss Ender's Game and what Ender from Ender's Game can teach us about leadership and strategic thinking. Anyway, fascinating discussion. I think you'll like it. You had a lot of takeaways, you got a lot of good nuggets there that you can start applying to your life today. So without further ado, Tom Ruby on strategic thinking. Tom Ruby, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Brett. It's really good to be here. I'm a huge fan from your early days.
All right. Well, I really appreciate that. So let's start with your story because it's really interesting. So you are right now an expert and consultant on strategic planning and critical thinking. But how did you get to this point? You actually have a pretty interesting background story. Can you give us up to date on how you got to where you are now?
Sure. It's odd. In some ways, I've lived almost a Forrest Gump-like life. I mean, I've been in the right place at the right time, not of my own doing necessarily, but Providence puts you there. And I think a lot of times it's, you know, do you make the most of your opportunities? I was born in Belgrade, Serbia, which was then Yugoslavia, behind the Iron Curtain. My mother's family were royalists who supported the crown and the pre-war government against the Germans and Tito's communists during World War II. So that set us up as enemies of the state when Tito came into power. When I was a year old, my mom and dad took me and did a no-kidding overnight escape out of the country. They made their way to Paris and then on to Los Angeles. I grew up in a working class home where my mom and dad both worked. My dad worked two jobs. I played football in high school and decided to go to the Air Force Academy after a recruiting visit there. I played football and that was fun, but I had a really, really tough time with the military side of the experience at first. And that was my first real taste of the need to turn, to what you espouse as the art of manliness. I realized that I was constantly making excuses and I needed to be more disciplined in my life and in my skills and my studies. Like you discussed with Dr. J in the episode on why your 20s are important, you become manly by doing manly things. So taking responsibility was a big one for me. After I graduated, got married to my wife, and I'm still married to my friend, we went off to our first duty assignment in South Carolina, and I was an intelligence officer in an F-16 wing. I noticed really early on that we were training for combat missions with a methodology that could potentially prove disastrous. Everybody at that time was about how low can you go, how fast and how low can you fly. And it was almost without regard to what the threat was going to be from the other side. Trying to explain that to my leadership was difficult because when you've done something for so long, it always seems right. If that makes sense. So when we deployed the Desert Shield in 1990, I really slowly and methodically showed my leadership why I thought that we needed to make a change from low-level tactics to higher altitude to give us a better chance of survivability. We did make that change, and a bunch of the other wings that were deployed also did the same thing. But it took several months to train to fly the new way. And then on the very first night of the war, back in 1991, those guys that flew in low were the first ones that got hit, by anti-aircraft fire and surface-to-air missiles. And really by the next day, everybody had changed our tactics. So when I returned from the war, the Air Force sent me to graduate school for the first time. And between a whole series of, going back to school and going to operational deployments and back to school and operational deployments, I got to apply some of the concepts I learned about in school or read about from other people. And I also got a chance to learn how to really patiently build momentum behind ideas. That's both within your peer group and with your leadership, to implement new ideas. So in 1997, I found myself deployed to Saudi Arabia at the headquarters enforcing the no-fly zone in Iraq. Our American, British, and French pilots were coming back every day saying that they were targeted by Iraqi surface-to-air missiles south of the no-fly zone line. But nobody in D.C. would believe anything they said. They were like, oh, these are just cowboy pilots, they're making it all up. And I'd get on the phone and say, why would anybody make that stuff up? And they'd say, well, because there's nothing there. And I'd say, well, could you look? Could you actually look and move some of our intel assets over there to look? And they'd say, why would we want to waste an asset to look for something that's not there? So, it was just really circular reasoning. And again, trying to build up some momentum among peers, I found some really good young people who were able to help. And we convinced the intel people one day to move some sensors to look where we were telling them to look. And suddenly, all these threats are there that weren't there to them the day before. And in their logic, oh my gosh, they just moved this stuff down. The only reason they could be doing this is because they're getting ready to invade. And we're telling them this stuff has been there for months. Okay? That was a really powerful lesson for me. You don't have to know everything in the world. But for the things that you're responsible for, you can't assume anything away. After that, I was selected to go get a PhD. And the light bulb really went off for me when I started taking methodology and critical thinking courses. That gave me a template for the first time to think about how to apply the things that I was learning to actual you know, real world situations of life and death. When I came back from getting my PhD, I was sent to Baghdad to conduct the Iraqi campaign progress review. I worked with an awesome British colonel, and we were just astounded by the lack of preparation from on everybody's standpoint for this huge international undertaking. Strategic planning is not a secret formula, Brett. I mean, you can find any number of checklists on the web that will take any family, any business, or any government entity through a process to get you where you want to achieve. But the U.S. military and our allies had gotten really lazy in the prospects about thinking about war. We show over and over again that when we get into a fight, we win the fight, and we can win every fight but lose the entire war because we don't think through the long term. Then when I came home from Baghdad for the last 8 years of my career through three different assignments, really I spent a lot of time on the road. I mean, countless weeks on the road giving seminars on critical thinking, strategic planning, and leadership development. I was asked to be on General Petraeus's Joint Strategic Assessment Team, which assessed the U.S. and allied strengths, weaknesses, and options in the entire Middle East and the Central Asia region. That resulted in a report that General Petraeus put on President Obama's desk right after his inauguration. And it got me thinking about what I wanted to do afterwards when I retired. I mean, because I couldn't stay in uniform forever. But I knew that I'd have lots of opportunities to get in with one of the big Beltway firms after I retired. But my wife and I had really, for a long time, wanted to get out of the city and move to our farm. So there was something that a friend told me years before that resonated with me. He was a small town newspaper editor, and he'd been courted by the New York Times for years. And he said, people in small towns deserve good journalism too. And that really made an impact with me. And I thought, you know, people in small towns and small and medium businesses deserve good consulting that's affordable as well. So that's when I started thinking about how to do this and settle down into, you know, building up a small consultancy that's networked with other good thinkers. And that's what I do today.
All right. So you basically take the things you learned, the skills and expertise you developed during your military career, and help organizations think strategically. So let's talk about maybe we're going down a rabbit hole, but what is strategy, right?
Awesome. Like, okay.
What's the difference between like strategy, tactics,
great,
doctrine? How would you define that?
There's a brilliant question. Okay. Before you can start with strategy is what links the ends that you want to achieve with the means that you have to do it. Okay, so if you think in from priority or from time priority, what comes first? You should always have a policy, i.e., what is it that we want to do? Okay, I want to go do this. So the what is your policy for your desired end? Okay, strategy is the how. Strategy is the how you can do it. So if you live in Oklahoma and you want to go to New York City, okay, your goal is to get to New York City. There's a multiple different ways of how you can do that, right? You can get on an airplane, you can drive a car, you can take a train, you can hitchhike. I mean, there's lots of different ways to do it in combinations of those things too. And then and strategy links the means by which you have it. If you don't have a ton of money, well, you can still get there, right? It might take you a little bit longer if you hitchhike, right? If you have a lot of money, well, you can, you know, charter an airplane or build yourself a hot air balloon. So strategy is the idea of connecting the what you want to do with the means that you have at your disposal to best figure out the way to do it.
We're going to take a quick break for a word from our sponsors. Hey, Art of Manliness listeners, I've said that the world belongs to those that hustle, but I'm also a big believer that the world belongs to the self-starters, people who are willing to take the initiative to learn new skills, to start that business. You can't just wait around for someone to tell you or bring opportunity to you. You got to go out and find it. That's why I love lynda.com. It's the place for self-starters. It's an online platform with over 3,000 on-demand video courses on a wide variety of topics: photography, videography, web design, personal development, like personal organization, business management, all sorts of skills. If you want to start a new business or upgrade your skills for your current job so you can get that promotion you've been wanting, if you want to try out lynda.com free, go to lynda.com/artofman and you'll get a free 10-day trial. You'll have access to all 3,000 of their video courses. Again, that's lynda, lynda.com/artofman. Also by Harry's.com. So we know that shaving can be a hassle, especially with those cartridge razors. You'll get the razor burn, the nicks, the bumps. It's a big reason why I switched over to safety razor shaving a few years ago. Well, Harry sent me a sample of their blades. I said, you know what, I'm going to give it a try. I tried it and I was pleasantly surprised by the shave. I didn't get the irritating bumps that I used to get with the name brand drugstore cartridges. Just a really comfortable shave. And what's great about Harry's as well is that it's half the price of what you'll pay at the drugstore. And get this, they deliver directly to your doorstep for free. Fantastic. Anyways, if you'd like to try Harry's out, go to harrys.com and Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in my coupon code manliness with your first purchase. Again, that's harrys.com, coupon code manliness to check out for $5 off and start shaving better today. So, you know, I'm always thinking, trying to become a better strategist. And so are there particular subtopics that individuals should study or research and read about so that they become better strategists?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best thing that you can do to be a strategist is to make yourself a critical thinker. And really to do that, you have to think really, really broadly. So not just one subject, not just be an expert in one thing, but try to learn as much as you can about as many different things. And I mean, you do this on your site. If you look at the manly skills, right, on Art of Manliness, you got pages and pages and pages of these things. And once you get good at one of these things, it's going to help you get good at others. Okay? And so, first of all, to be a good strategist, you have to be able to think broadly beyond just, you know, one little thing at one time. Okay, so I recommend that people pick up all kinds of books, okay, not just history books, because you'll get a lot of guys that'll say, well, you know, the only really manly books are biographies and history, and I think that those are very manly, okay, but biographies and histories can tell you what happened to a person or at an event in a given time, given a certain context, but if the context today is different, then the variables today are going to be different than they were back then. And, you know, if you follow the same, you know, the same steps that somebody did in another case that was different from yours, you're going to come up with a different result. So, you know, I really recommend people to read fiction, to read novels, to read histories, to read biographies, three books outside of your comfort zone. And, you know, I recommend to my own clients to spend an hour a day during your duty day to read and go look at something outside of what you do, okay? There's a great Harvard Business Review article from 2009 on the innovator's DNA. It's called the innovator's DNA. And they talk about the top CEOs are those guys that go around and look at not just their businesses and their segment of industry, but other segments of industry or other industries altogether. I have a client now that was just saying that he goes out and he looks at how fruits are arranged at hotels and wonders about how he can make his business, you know, how he can take that lesson and apply it to his own business. That's what makes a good strategist, okay? Continually pushing the boundaries of the possible, okay? Not just, you know, when you see people in tests, right, that are given, you know, that are given like a rope and a nail. What can you do with this? And it's the children that always come up with the most outrageous ideas that are really cool, right? Because they haven't grown up enough where people tell them that's dumb or you shouldn't do that, right? And I think that if you constantly challenge yourself to see the world in new ways, that's going to help you be the best strategist around.
So this sounds very somewhat similar to like John Boyd's thinking with the OODA loop.
Amen.
Where you, the idea, you know, in order to become a better strategist and in order to succeed at the OODA loop, you need to develop as many mental models as possible from a wide variety of fields. What's amazing with his OODA loop, like he brought in, just to develop that, he brought in several different mental models from, from thermodynamics to cybernetics to quantum physics, just to develop that idea. But by cross-pollinating all those different theorems and ideas from science, he's able to come up with this very simple mental model for success in the battlefield and success in any type of conflict.
You know, Brett, you're absolutely right. To piggyback on what you're just talking about, John Boyd, Scott Page, okay, PAGE from University of Michigan, published a book in, I think it was 2010, it might have been 2009, called The Difference. And it was a look at how expertise is almost in every case trumped by diversity. And you know, James Surowiecki in his book The Wisdom of Crowds kind of wrote about that, and a lot of people poo-pooed that. But what Page does is he goes and says, you can find any expert in any field and ask him a question. And almost invariably, if you ask, you know, a random group of people who know nothing about or that are not experts in that field the same question and take the mean answer, it's always going to be more accurate than the experts. And that's what made Boyd so brilliant, but it's also what made Boyd so threatening, you know, to his own leadership. Okay. Leadership in almost any business, and especially in the military, are threatened by guys, you know, people that try to bring in ideas that are outside of the experience of that organization.
So you were saying you've written an article how the military is anti-intellectual. And is this what you mean by being anti-intellectual? They're not open to new ideas?
In a sense, yes. I mean, the original title of the article was the impact of anti-intellectualism in the U.S. military. But, you know, it got changed when it was published in the American Interest. But the real point there is that anti-intellectuals are not dumb, okay? They're actually really intelligent people, but they value experience and doing over thinking, okay? Richard Hofstadter wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book called Anti-Intellectualism in American Life in 1969. And, you know, one of the Art of Manliness' favorites, Teddy Roosevelt, he played a significant role, albeit not purposefully, in the anti-intellectual movement, okay? Teddy Roosevelt was a fierce intellectual, right? But he was also a doer, okay? And when he wrote his famous poem, The Man in the Arena, right? That still resonates today. And what you'll get is you'll get people that are just doers, and they can't take anybody asking them, how do you know that's going to work? Okay. They'll say, hey man, I'm the guy in the arena. I've been there. Okay. I'll give you an example. When I was in Baghdad, we were going to go, quote, do Fallujah, unquote, for the fourth time. Okay. And the colonel that was doing the planning for the operation, I went over to him and I just asked him, if we do this again tomorrow, is it going to necessarily and deliberately lead us to the attainment of our objectives? And he said, that's the problem with you pointy-headed ivory tower academic types. You know nothing about war, okay? And, I mean, first, it's really condescending. But second, it also shows a lack of willingness to consider that even the possibility that there might be a better way or that you might be wrong. Mike Warden wrote a book called Rise of the Fighter Generals. And he makes a brilliant case that when the Strategic Air Command was at its ascendancy, not only within the Air Force, but within the Department of Defense, I mean, you know, Curtis LeMay was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and we had SAC generals that were in all the key positions. They got so, they became ossified, in his, in Mike Warden's words, you know, like petrified wood, because they were so fixated on training and sitting alert that they didn't think, and they didn't think outside, you know, their own day-to-day activities. And while they were just sitting alert and training, the bomber guys, or sorry, the fighter guys, were sending their best officers to schools and sending them to career broadening assignments and sending them overseas to exchanges. And almost overnight, without even realizing it, the bomber generals found themselves on the out and out, and then the fighter generals were in ascendancy. And yet today, those same fighter generals have ossified at least as much, if not more so, than the bomber guys did from that time. And Boyd is a great example. John Boyd isn't even discussed or mentioned among Air Force leadership today. But when I wrote that article on anti-intellectualism, and it was published back in 2009, a couple of colonels on the at the Pentagon said, "Dude, this is going to end your career." And I said, if I'm right in what I wrote, then the senior leadership either won't even know that the article exists, or if they do stumble upon it, they won't do anything. I ended up getting a lot of feedback from people in other branches of government and in industry, but not a single word from anybody in senior leadership. So as far as outside the military, I think Hofstetter's still right. Anti-intellectualism is still strong. Again, he doesn't say that anti-intellectuals aren't smart, but they just value doing over thinking. And what you see today is the best companies, the most successful companies out there are the ones that meld the two together, okay, that find the practitioner scholar, okay, that finds the person that can think and do at the same time. They can constantly say, how can I do this better, that's an outstanding practitioner, but is also aware of what's the latest thing out there that I can use.
So I think there is a tendency for individuals, organizations to, you get comfortable, right? Something's worked before.
Yep.
And so you keep doing it, and then you run into a problem. And the typical response for organizations or for people even is that, well, the problem is I just need to do more of what I have been doing, and that will fix things.
Yeah, harder, better, longer.
Harder, better, longer, right?
Work longer, and we need to be better. But at some point, you have to ask yourself, how will I know? I mean, what are my criteria going to be to know that this doesn't work, okay? So when people say to me, we just need to work harder, we need to work better, and we need to work longer, I say, okay, at what point are you going to know whether or not that works? And it's not a challenge. It's a serious question. When will you know if that worked or not? So, you know, I think one of the things that you should always think about in critical thinking, this comes from Alec Fisher's book, The Logic of Real Arguments. Really, really good book that, you know, there's a few books that I always gave my direct subordinates that worked for me, and this was one of them, The Logic of Real Arguments. And he starts off by saying, it's amazing what you can figure out about a subject just by thinking about it. And you think to yourself, well, duh, but really, there's some profoundness there when he says, ask yourself some basic questions. If that's true, what should I expect to see? So that's one of the questions that I always challenge my mentorees and my clients with when they say, well, this is going to happen. And I'll say, okay, if that's true, what should we expect to see? Okay. And how long are you going to give it to see that? Another question is, what would I have to know or accept in order to believe that to be true? All right. What would I have to know or accept in order to believe that to be true? And another simple question is, how do I know? Okay. A very, very critical part of planning okay, strategic planning and critical thinking is listing all of your assumptions. Okay? We go through life, Brett, really do, right? We go through life assuming that certain things are going to happen. And at some level, to get anywhere, you have to, like, for example, if you're going to make your trip from Oklahoma to New York City and you're going to drive, it's a reasonable assumption that you're going to have find open gas stations along the way, right? But there may be lots of other assumptions that you make without even thinking about it. And so one of them would be that lots of people make is they get in a car and they don't realize that they've made an assumption that they're not going to get a flat tire the whole way there, right?
Yeah.
And when they get a flat, they open up their trunk and they got a spare, okay, and they've got the jack, but they don't have that little mechanism that hooks into the jack to spin around, right? And so, and you say, well, I didn't know that. Well, that's because you made an assumption that you wouldn't need it, all right? And it's a very difficult step in the strategic planning process, and maybe the most critical of all the steps in the strategic planning process, to sit yourself down or your leadership team, whoever it is that's going to be doing your plan with you, and to, no kidding, list out all of the assumptions that you're making, okay, for whatever the foreseeable time frame is that you're working. And then you aggressively challenge those assumptions and then try to validate them, okay? So if somebody wants to open a restaurant, right? I was helping somebody that opened a restaurant, and they couldn't understand why their restaurant was empty on a Wednesday night, okay? Well, we said, in the South, people go to church on Wednesday nights. And they said, well, who goes to church on a Wednesday night? And we said, well, you see, here you are. You're opening a business with a fundamental assumption that hasn't been validated. And those are just simple ones. Here's another one. If you're going to open your restaurant, okay, if you're going to have a specialty type restaurant that serves a certain type of specialty food, you need to know that your supplier is going to be able to deliver it to you all the days that you need it, right?
Yeah.
And so we go through life, whether it's in a family or whether it's in a small business or whether it's in a county government or whether it's in a large military, starting operations without having actually listed and challenged and validated your assumptions.
I really love that idea, and I can see that being very helpful on the individual level. So I think a lot of people have their goals frustrated because they don't stop to think about those assumptions and question those assumptions that they have, because they don't think about, well, I got this goal to, I don't know, get this job at X place. And then they don't think about, well, there's going to be lots of other people competing for it. Maybe there's something will happen with the business that they won't allow me to get that job. You know, they have to take back on or roll back on hiring, for example. So yeah, I like that idea.
Even something as simple as, you know, if you want to build a treehouse, right? You can save yourself 10 trips to Lowe's by sitting down and writing out the things that you need.
Yeah.
You know? I got plenty of that in the garage. I got plenty of those nails.
I do that all the time.
You know, I got plenty of those screws. Well, think about this. It's not unmanly, okay? It is not unmanly to go check to see if you actually have the screws that you think you do, okay? In fact, I would say that it's far manlier to go check yourself and to make one trip instead of having to make a whole bunch of trips, you know, because you say, well, crap, I really thought I had what I needed.
Yeah, I do that all the time. Whenever I have a project around the house, I end up making like 5 trips to Home Depot. One thing that I've helped too, so besides checking first, is also when you're at Home Depot, whenever you're there, buy more than you think you're going to need.
Amen. That's right.
Right.
Because you're going to need them next time.
Exactly. Or even if it's not a next time, like, you know, assume that you're going to mess up the first time and you're going to need that extra material. So that's my bit of life advice there for you guys. Yeah. You're going to do stuff around your house. Buy extra.
Completely agree with you. And I did my treehouse with my kids a couple years ago. It was great to have a whole pouch of extra screws with me, you know, 16 feet up in the trees, because you can't get mad at the kids when they drop a screw.
Yeah.
You know?
They're just trying to help.
Need more.
So here's a question I have. So you were talking about, we were talking about John Boyd and, and you, getting that feedback saying that your career is going to be over for this article that you wrote. And John Boyd had that, you know, same sort of problem. Like he didn't advance past lieutenant colonel, I believe, in his career. He should have been a general, I think, but that didn't happen for him.
Yeah, he should have been a general, but he was a colonel.
He was a colonel. Right. So here's a question I have. So how do you balance, right? So, you know, Boyd said that you can either be someone or do something in life.
That's brilliant.
And to be someone you in the military or any organization, you sort of have to be a yes man, sort of go with the flow, don't rock the boat. But if you want to do something, you have to, piss people off, for lack of a better word, and you're going to hurt your career.
It's so funny that you say that. You know, but you were going to say buck the system, weren't you?
Yeah, I was going to say buck the system, but you know, you it seems that you just piss people off, you irritate them.
You know, so
how do you balance that? I mean, so there's a part of me where I'm like, yeah, I want to like, you know, stick it to the man, I want to do something. But at the same time, you're like, well, I got a family, right? If I lose my job, or if my career doesn't advance, like that's not going to just hurt me. It's going to hurt, you know, my kids who have nothing to do with this. So what's your insight? How do you balance that? Well, I got to support my family, so I kind of have to go along. But at the same time, I actually want to do something.
Brett, I think that's a brilliant, brilliant question. And it's a genuine and legitimate concern that people have. And it's a really legitimate concern, but I will tell you that it starts with a mindset. Okay. And that mindset is not that you either buck the system or go along. Okay. On the day of my promotion to colonel, my absolutely loving wife, who's really quiet and normally shy, told somebody, see, he bucked the system and still got promoted. And I really gently asked her not to say that again, because I didn't buck the system. I looked for an alternative path within the system. And so that's the mindset that I took, is instead of fighting the system, look to see if there's an alternative path within it. Okay. There's a respectful way that we can say to our bosses and to our peers that we can do better, instead of saying, hey, we stink, right? You can advance in your career by going along as time honored, right? The Japanese culture, the Japanese corporate culture, in which the salaryman says, man, when I'm going to be a manager, I'm going to change things. But when to get there, he has to be so completely co-opted by the system that he can't make the changes that he wanted to make. So how do you make that change? First, you have to understand that any meaningful change is going to be slow change, okay? I know that you've read countless articles about disruptive change, right?
Yeah.
People always say, yeah, we need disruptive change. Actually, disruptive change is not really helpful, okay? Disruption really disrupts people's lives. It disrupts your operations, okay? And that disruption often fails because people can't cope with the pace of the change. So if it's really important, if it's worth doing, then it's worth doing slowly, okay, and by building up a snowball. So that's what I always found the best way to do things. I'd start by making sure that my ideas are going to work, okay? I'd try to patiently pitch my ideas to colleagues that I would really trust to tell me, you know, to wave the BS flag if they needed to, or to say, hey man, I think that can really work. Okay. You listen to their input, then you go to your boss. Okay. One of my maxims is that they can't say no if you don't ask. I tell all my clients and I tell all my mentorees that you'd be amazed at what your bosses will let you do if you just ask them. Okay. And if you think about this from a sociology standpoint, it makes sense, because the boss will get the credit if it works, and he won't take the blame if it doesn't.
Yeah.
Right? So always look to make things better wherever you are. Be ready to show your supportive reasoning. Okay. Now, I've had guys say, I think we should do this. And I say, well, why do you think that's going to work? And they say, why do I have to give you evidence, man? Why can't I just tell you what I think? And the answer is, well, really, because nobody gives a crap what you think. if you can't show any evidence, right? So your gut feel is never going to be sufficient reasoning. But when you can come to your boss with a good idea and with some evidence, you'll be really surprised at how often that one change will lead to a cascade of changes that will make the company a new place, and it'll give you opportunities to rise.
So play the long game.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're, you know, now listen, you can't play the long game if there's nothing wrong with this. If you're hopping from job to job to job, okay, you can't play the long game for any of the companies. You can play the long game for yourself, okay, but you're never going to make meaningful change in those companies.
Gotcha. So you wrote an interesting article I thought was fascinating. It was about Ender's Game, right? And like you, mm-hmm. I was late to the game on this book because, like, I always thought it was a book. I didn't read it when I was a kid. It's sort of a book geared towards young adults. And, yeah, I just never read it. But I finally got around to it, and it's an awesome book. If you haven't read Ender's Game yet, read it. But you wrote an article that Ender can actually teach us a lot about strategic planning, leadership, and within large organizations. So what can Ender teach us about being better strategists and better leaders?
Yeah, listen, like you, I was a really latecomer to Ender's Game. I had, you know, from the time I was in my early 20s, I had people recommending to me to read Ender's Game. And then when I was in grad school getting my PhD, a professor says to me, "You've never read Ender's Game?" At that point, I said, "All right, this is dumb." I bought the paperback, and it was like a gut punch. I mean, it was a total gut punch. What an idiot I was for not having read this book. And then I had an opportunity to meet Orson Scott Card when he came to Lexington on a book tour. And I stood in line with everybody else, and I just thanked him for what he said. And he looks up and he says, "Yeah, you don't look like everybody else in this line." And I said, "No." And he asked me what I did, and I told him what I was doing. And that led to a long correspondence and a really close friendship. And I brought him to the staff college when I was a vice dean at the Air Command Staff College to speak a couple of times. And he asked me to write a chapter on Ender on leadership for his book, Ender's World. And I really think that, you know, people lose sight of a really important fact of this book is that Scott Card didn't set out to write a book about science fiction or the future. He set out to write a book about sociology and moral situations and dilemmas, you know, and how to face those. And that's where I think the real leadership and manhood skills come in. Okay. The first lesson from Ender's Game is that skill and excellence are a means to advancement and a threat to your peers and to your bosses. So if you're really good at what you do, let your work speak for itself, okay? Be humble. Second, if what you're doing doesn't work well, at some point you have to consider that doing it again and again and again also won't work well. Find another way. Think through alternatives. Look for those people around you that have good ideas and then lift them up by empowering them to try their own ideas and practice. This is exactly how Ender built his team. He was given the dregs that nobody else wanted, right? And what did he do with them? He found what each one of those, you know, kids was best at and used them for that at the right time, all right? He realized that everyone had different capabilities, but he made the most of every person's best and put them where they were needed most when they were needed most. And then Ender does something else that's really hard for all of us. I mean, I think this is one of the most important things that we can get out of strategic planning and critical thinking. Ender accepts the world as it is, not how he'd like it to be, right? Mm. So many people get hung up on obstacles, and they complain about something that won't do anything about. And then they start banging on their steering wheel, right? What's the only thing that's going to fix the flat? You getting out and fixing the flat, right? And then again, I mentioned above being humble. Ender was never too proud to ask for help, and he made it, and to make others better. The best leaders in any field of industry aren't measured by what they do. They're measured by, I think, okay, how many of their own former subordinates are promoted or hired away to other leadership jobs. Okay. That was Ender. Okay. They took every one of his kids and made them commanders.
That's awesome.
And I think that, you know, I try to tell my clients, I try to tell my mentorees, you've really made it if your people get hired away from you.
It's a good thought. Before I did the whole Art of Manliness thing full-time, I had a boss who was like that. I decided to, I told him, you know, I'm going to do this thing full-time. I have to quit. I felt really bad leaving because he was a good guy. And he's like, no, that's awesome. Do it. I think that's fantastic. And there's like no grudges. He was like, he was happy for me. And I thought that was like a sign of like a good manager.
Amen.
So, here's a question I have, and you talk about critical thinking, but are there biases that you see over and over again that cause the most problems for leaders and organizations?
Yeah, there sure are. And I think, Steve Levitt and Steve Dubber, freaking Oxfam, they'll tell you that, have you ever heard them say what the three hardest words in the English language are? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I found this to be spot on. The greatest mistake that senior leaders can make is lacking the humility to consider that there's something that they're not doing right, or to admit that there's something that they don't know. You know, you were talking a little while ago about organizations that have been doing things the same way for a long time. They expect that tomorrow is going to look just like today, right? Well, the sun's risen the last, 8 days. It's going to rise again tomorrow. That's pretty good. Not invented here is a huge bias that hurts organizations. On the other hand, the most successful organizations and leaders are those who make it part of their culture for people to interact outside their own specialty. Okay? So if it doesn't really matter. If you're a lawyer and you can talk about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, somehow or another, that's going to make you a better lawyer. Okay? If you can talk about the sociology of power distance indices, okay, and, who's going to talk to you and give you bad news and who won't when you really need to hear it. Just stepping outside of your bounds and being willing to say, I don't know, help me. I think that's the most important bias that any leader needs to get over.
I think it's an important one because one thing I noticed too with people who succeed in one area and they become a leader, they have a tendency, and I think other people have this tendency too, to see them as experts in a wide variety of topics, right? So like a doc, a lot of people do this, like, okay, well, you're successful in X business, so I'm going to ask you for advice about my business that's completely different. And the guy thinking he's flattered because, well, this guy asked me and he'll give an answer, but he doesn't know anything about that business. So he can't really give good advice.
Yeah. I've had people ask me, well, how come you don't do, pardon me, finance and marketing and IT, consulting? You're a consultant. Shouldn't you be doing that? And I said, well, I got to limit myself to something that I'm really competent at. Okay. What I would really, really hate to do is to tell you, yeah, I'll help you with your finance stuff and then not succeed. Yeah. and then have you tell, your peers, don't go to that guy. I would rather undersell and overdeliver.
Yeah.
Okay. Or underpromise and overdeliver. Now, on the other hand, I'm going to continue to try to get, wiser and wiser on those things that I don't know about. And if somebody asks me, hey, can you help me with this? And I can't do it. Well, I'll get somebody within my own network who can help me.
So you have this great list of maxims you have on your website. I love maxims. Big fan of like Balthazar Gratian and other guys who just wrote aphorisms. I think I love the idea of packing in as much wisdom as you can into a short amount of words. So how did you develop this list of maxims, and can you share a few with us?
Sure. Well, I was I was a professor at the Air Command Staff College, which is the Air Force's graduate school that they send the top majors to every year for a year, sit in seminar. And while I was there, teaching, I was also going off and giving seminars at other universities, at the NATO school, at foreign defense colleges as well. And everywhere I went, people would start asking me, hey, you mentioned these books and you mentioned these sayings on the board. Can we have a list of them? And I realized, I really need to put these on paper. So I came up with a list of maxims. And some of them are, goodness breeds goodness. Seek balance in life. Truth doesn't change based on the rank of the recipient. If you have to eat a frog, staring at it won't make it go down any easier. Iron sharpens iron, and bloom where you're planted. And so almost every one of these comes from real life experiences, or multiple real life experiences.
I love the one, bloom where you're planted. Because I think, especially for young people, because I think a lot of young people have this idea that in order to succeed in life or to really get something out of life, they have to go somewhere else, right? They got to go to the big city. They got to leave their state. But I really think there's a virtue in deciding, I'm going to stick where I'm at and see what I can do here. And that's what I've done. I live in Tulsa, Oklahoma still. A lot of people ask me, why don't you move to San Francisco, New York City, or there's sort of like there's more... more connections. It's like, I like doing what I'm doing where I'm here.
Right. Brett, I think that's brilliant. Those words came from a really good friend of mine, Scott Duffel. Used to be a general and now he's a consultant himself. And we used to speak together quite a bit. We would go do a tag team on leadership and leadership development occasionally. And we would get the young kids that really had stars in their eyes. Okay, I really want to get ahead fast. What is my quickest route to senior leadership? And we would tell them to bloom where you're planted, that you get promoted in any business, in any segment of industry, by doing what your boss tells you to do. Okay? Not by fighting, okay? And so, like I said, you don't have to always be the yes man, okay? You could do what your boss wants you to do by telling him that there's a better way to do it, okay? But that's how you bloom where you're planted. And a lot of people say, well, I don't like that job. That's a crap job. That's beneath me. But you know what? Sometimes bosses just want to see if you have the humility to do that job. They know that you're capable. There's a great movie, that 1964 movie called The Cardinal, produced by Otto Preminger, with John Huston was an Academy Award nominee, and Tom Tryon was a young priest who rose to be a cardinal. But he was really good, and he knew that he was smart. And early on, he asked his bishop, for a really good posting. And the bishop sent him out into the hinterlands to work for in a small community that wasn't even a village, And it was essentially to say, could you be humble? And he did. He bloomed where he was planted, and he rose. And that's just it's a great story, and it's a great analogy for getting ahead today in the world.
Fantastic. Well, Tom, this has been a fantastic, really fascinating discussion. You've referenced a lot of books, your maxims, of course. Where can people find more about your work and like the books you recommend for becoming better strategists?
Thanks, Brett. They can go to my website. I have they can go to criticalthinkingsolutions.com or BGCTS.com. That stands for Bluegrass Critical Thinking Solutions. They can look me up on Facebook, Google my name, Tom Rudy, and Critical Thinking, and it'll come up with the website. And on the website, they can you can read my maxims. You can look at my reading list. It's available for everybody. Articles that I've written and ones that I you know, that I recommend other people read. I hope everybody, you know, can be intrigued enough to find one book off that reading list that they haven't seen, and go read it.
Awesome. Well, it's a good list. I've checked it out. I love a good reading list, and got a few in my queue now because of it.
Thanks, Brett.
All right. Well, Tom Ruby, thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure.
And it's been a pleasure talking to you too, Brett. Thanks.
Our guest today was Tom Ruby. He is the owner of Bluegrass Critical Thinking Solutions, and you can find out more information about Tom and his work at bgcts.com. Again, that's bgcts.com. Check it out. Lots of great free content out there you can read and peruse and add to your strategic repertoire. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Art of Manliness podcast. For more manly tips and advice, make sure to check out the Art of Manliness website at artofmanliness.com. And if you like this podcast and you're getting something out of it, I'd really appreciate it if you go to iTunes or Stitcher or whatever it is you use to listen to the podcast and give us a review. That will really help us out, and your feedback will help us out as well. Until next time, this is Brett McKay telling you to stay manly.